Okay, welcome to the show. Once again, you're the cure. Dr. Ben Edwards here. I'm honored to have a special guest today via telephone. Dr. Dominic D'Agostino, professor at the University of South Florida. And Dr. D'Agostino is maybe known to some of you out there who have been following us because we've been talking about the ketogenic diet so much. And I think he's kind of one of the gurus, one of the go-to sources. And we've had Dr. Fung on the show talking about intermittent fasting, and we've talked some keto, but I would say Dr. Dominic D'Agostino is going to be the guru, the one we point to probably the most as far as the research goes. And when people ask us questions about the ketogenic diet, we always like to have evidence-based stuff to point to. So we're so happy to have Dr. D'Agostino, which I may just ask you if it's okay to call you Dominic. I always get hung up on that last name. But thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Ben, and I appreciate being on.
All right. Well, I always like with our guest to start with kind of your story and how you got into what you're doing. I mean, we're out here in West Texas in a pretty conservative part of the country, and even just doing holistic medicine or alternative medicine like I do, we're still in the mode of almost trying to renew people's mind or open their mind, and that there's a different way to a different approach, not just West Texas. I think all of America, we're just stuck in this old mindset of conventional medicine. And I wasn't taught nutrition in medical school, unfortunately. I only got a couple hours of nutrition in 4 years of med school. I mean, and all other doctors, I think, are in the same boat. So when I have patients come in and say, "Well, my other doctor said X, Y, and Z about a diet," it's hard for me not to roll my eyes because I know, well, that doctor probably doesn't really know, and probably sort of made that up because that's what I used to do because I didn't really have solid nutrition education. So, anyways, it's such a focus of our practice now, but we still come up against these mindsets, especially low fat kind of mindset. And when we tell people to eat fat and occasionally don't eat and fasting's good, I mean, these are just such new concepts. Although you've been in the field for a long time now. And it's great to have kind of an expert come in, validate, and explain and get into the science behind some of these recommendations. But if you don't mind, start for our listeners with just a little bit of your background, sort of where you came from and how you got to where you are today, and then we'll get into some more of the details.
Sure. Well, when it comes to nutrition, I had an interest, I would say, going back into high school. I would read magazines like Men's Health and Muscle and Fitness and just try to stay up on nutrition more as a means to sort of enhance my kind of energy and performance when it came to football. And also, I was into mountain bike racing and riding at the time. And decided to major in nutrition and also major in biology when I went to college, Rutgers University. And nutrition wasn't really, it was kind of not a hard, it wasn't considered like a hard science, I would say. Like, it was more like a soft science. So in the 1990s, it was kind of the decade of the brain. So when I finished my undergrad, I applied to a neuroscience and physiology program. And thinking that that was it, I was kind of more fascinated with neuroscience. So I actually studied the neuroscience of physiology, how our brain controls our autonomic regulation when it comes to respiration and heart rate, really with a focus on the neural control of respiration and how that our brain patterns change, our respiratory patterns change when we are faced with things like hypoxia or when there's an alteration in the brainstem mechanisms of sensing oxygen and CO2. CO2 being the major driver for our respiration, actually. But I focus mostly on oxygen and hypoxia. So that work, during that time, I got very into scuba diving as I was doing my PhD research. I didn't have a whole lot of time to do it, but I would probably do it maybe about once a month. I got into scuba diving, and that led me to take a postdoctoral fellowship in Ohio at the time to studying the other end of the spectrum, which is hyperoxia, high pressure oxygen, as it relates to divers. And military divers are faced with oxygen toxicity problems. And I during my postdoc fellowship, wrote grants to the Office of Navy Research and Department of Defense. And my research then got funded to study the cellular and molecular mechanisms of oxygen toxicity seizures, which are a limitation of our special operations community that use a closed circuit rebreather. And I was mostly focused on drug research, but then discovered that the ketogenic diet was actually the standard of care. It was accepted by neurologists as a means to control seizures when drugs failed. And little did I know, it was actually more effective than drugs. You know, when multiple anti-epileptic drugs fail, sort of the last resort is to fall back on nutrition. And it was just kind of interesting to me that it wasn't a frontline approach. And then the epileptologist or neurologist would actually have to hire a registered dietitian, because the medical doctors didn't really know a lot about nutrition to implement the ketogenic diet. And a lot of work was being done at Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins, and they were the people I originally reached out to. So I guess in 2008, or 2009, 2008, around that time, my whole research program shifted over to study the anti-seizure neuroprotective effects of nutritional ketosis. And that's how I got steered in that direction, you know, and actually studying this as a countermeasure to enhance safety and resilience in military divers.
Okay. Fascinating. Well, and I love that point about the ketogenic diet being standard of care. And that's going back, I think I've heard you say, even 100 years. We've known that this type of diet is very, produces good results in patients with seizures.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, back in the 1920s and 1930s and 40s, we didn't really have anti-epileptic drugs. So it was really the only option. Typically, a patient would fast for like 24 hours to initiate, to get them into ketosis. And then they would get inducted into ketosis and really start a diet that was up to 90% fat. And now we know we don't need to have the ratios that high of fat, that we can have more modified versions of the ketogenic diet that are a little more user-friendly to follow. And the diet, you know, had a very, very good track record for controlling seizures, better than any anti-epileptic drug that we have available, actually, even today, which is pretty amazing. So pharmaceutical companies, you know, are actually spending quite a bit of time and money. And, you know, I've been traveling to pharmaceutical companies giving lectures on this, and they are trying to really get the ketogenic diet in a drug, which is going to be hard to do because it works through so many mechanisms in synchrony. By changing your metabolic physiology, that changes your brain energy metabolism and ultimately the neuropharmacology of the brain and many signaling pathways, including inflammation. So the next paper we hope to get out very soon is showing that by reducing neuroinflammation, that can have profound effects at reducing seizures, different types of seizures, especially things like absent seizures, but also tonic-clonic seizures. Wow. So as we started looking at the neuroprotective anti-seizure effects of the ketogenic diet, we started exploring the use of the ketogenic diet for many other applications, including things like wound healing, things like lowering blood glucose as it relates to type 2 diabetes. We have half of what I do right now is actually cancer research at the Moffitt Cancer Center, a big tier 1 cancer center here. We have a number of preclinical animal model studies going on, and we have a clinical trials grant being reviewed now by the National Institutes of Health. The National Cancer Institute is looking at nutrition, finally, as a therapeutic approach, especially for brain cancers that are associated with seizures. So not only can the diet potentially, you know, control the seizures in patients with brain tumors, but they can also knock down many of the drivers that cause the growth and proliferation of cancers. And then we study a wide range of neurometabolic disorders like glucose transporter deficiency syndrome, and a number of different disorders that are sort of associated with metabolism, and even genetic disorders that cause seizures. Kabuki syndrome and Angelman syndrome are two pretty active programs we have here, looking at nutritional ketosis with a diet and even with a ketone ester and various ketone supplements that can induce a state of therapeutic ketosis and circumvent the need for the dietary restriction to achieve a state of therapeutic ketosis. Because the ketogenic diet, although I follow it and find it to be fairly easy to follow, for some people are unwilling or unable to follow a ketogenic diet just due to maybe a fat intolerance or, you know, for ethical reasons or cultural reasons, they just can't follow a ketogenic diet. So we also developed the ketone supplements can allow a person to get into a state of ketosis very fast, and you can adjust the dosage to elevate the ketones to where they need to be. And the military is kind of interested in that because of the ability to rapidly induce ketosis prior to a dive and then sustain it for a predetermined amount of hours. So we study about, you know, 10 or 12 different applications of the ketogenic diet, and it all stemmed from studying oxygen toxicity seizures, really, in our work with the Navy and the Special Operations Community.
Wow, that's fascinating. One point I want to reiterate for the listeners, when you said the pharmaceutical companies are trying to develop a drug that can kind of mimic this and that'll be hard to do because the ketogenic diet has such a wide range of effects. I mean, it's working on multiple different pathways, multiple different results are happening throughout the body. And that's kind of the whole point of nutrition and the whole point of let thy food be thy medicine and thy medicine be thy food. When you try to isolate things in a pharmacological agent, although sometimes necessary and even beneficial in some scenarios, your overall thought process should not be isolated pharmacological therapy when you can get so much more done through the food because you're hitting multiple pathways. So just wanted to highlight that for our patients and our listeners. I think we need to go back just for those who maybe are new and maybe don't eat. This is the first time they're even hearing the word ketogenic diet, although it's so popular now, I think a lot of people hear about it, but even those people, they've heard about it, maybe don't understand it. Could you give sort of a layman's definition or explanation of what is that diet and even maybe a little bit into the metabolism of the cell and what's going on there and how a cell uses fuel and the different fuel options and stuff like that. Just a little bit of explanation on the diet.
Yeah, sure. Well, the ketogenic diet is the easiest diet to actually define because it's the only diet that is defined by an elevation of a very specific biomarker, and that's ketone levels either in the urine or in the blood. And those ketone levels are achieved with a very specific macronutrient ratio that needs to be eaten by the person. So a ratio of fat, protein, and carbohydrates need to be maintained. But I think maybe we'll take a step back from there and just talk about fasting, because fasting, you can also achieve ketosis, and we call that fasting ketosis. That can be achieved by withholding food, by limiting your intake of food. After about 24 hours, you start to enter a state of mild fasting ketosis. And essentially what that means is that under normal conditions with a normal American diet, we are fueling our bodies with carbohydrates primarily, and those carbohydrates turn into sugar, and sugar we eat, you know, also is sugar in the blood. And that sugar fuels our cells, our brain, and peripheral tissues. And in the absence of eating, the stored form of carbohydrate in the body, in the form of glycogen in the liver, will be depleted in a normal person, if they're active within, you know, 24 to 48 hours. And when you deplete the stores of your sugar or glycogen in your liver, you start to quickly mobilize fat from your adipose tissue. And that fat is a very efficient fuel for your heart, for your peripheral tissues, but does not really get used efficiently by the brain, because the blood-brain barrier prevents long-chain fatty acids from really entering the brain. So the through fatty acid oxidation in the body, in particular the liver, we start to break down excess fat in the liver, and those fats convert to ketone bodies through accelerated fat oxidation, starts to make acetyl-CoA, and then acetyl-CoA can condense to acetoacetate and then beta-hydroxybutyrate. Acetoacetate and beta-hydroxybutyrate are the two primary ketone bodies that are in circulation in our blood. And if we measure urine ketones, we're measuring acetoacetate. And if we measure blood ketones, it's typically beta-hydroxybutyrate, which is a little bit more stable form of ketone molecule. So it's a little bit higher concentration in the blood. And acetoacetate can spontaneously decarboxylate to something called acetone. And you can smell that on the breath of people in ketosis. And these ketone bodies essentially they replace glucose as the primary fuel for the brain after fasting about 48 to 72 hours. You know, the blood levels of ketones will start to approach the blood levels of glucose. So you are preferentially using ketone bodies as a source of brain energy. So a ketogenic diet actually has a macronutrient ratio that's very different than what we're told to eat. It is very high in fat, anywhere between 90 to 65% fat. The protein is relatively low in protein. And many people think the ketogenic diet is a high protein diet, and it's really not. It's actually, you know, originally it was very, very low protein diet. But now through the years, they found that it's important to kind of up the protein a little bit, because kids on a ketogenic diet had reduced growth. So now a ketogenic diet is anywhere from 10 to 25% protein, depending on how it's adjusted for the patient. So it's moderate protein to prevent protein deficiency and very restricted in carbohydrates. The carbohydrate sources of the ketogenic diet are primarily green vegetables, raw vegetables, things like salads, some fruits like avocado, maybe a few strawberries here and there. But it really comes down to the ratio of fat to protein to carbohydrates. And there's different, generally speaking, the modified ketogenic diet that's used in adult epilepsy patients is about 75% fat, roughly 20% protein, and only about 5% carbohydrates, you know, for the clinical management of epilepsy. And then there's a little bit more liberal when it comes to things like treating type 2 diabetes or more metabolic disorders. So eating that macronutrient ratio lowers the hormone insulin, which is often elevated in people with, you know, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, obesity. And by suppressing the hormone insulin, that accelerates globally in our body the release and the oxidation of stored fat. So we have accelerated fat oxidation in the body. And like I said, fat oxidation will increase blood levels of ketones. So a ketone in the blood or the urine is actually a very good indicator that your body is metabolizing and burning a lot of fat. So that's why, you know, a state of ketosis is a pretty reliable indicator that you are burning fat. And when you're in this state, acutely, there are many positive effects like controlling seizures. And then there are things that happen on a time scale of weeks and even years, where we're talking about changes in neurotransmitters, changes in the different types of receptors in the body. Fatty acid oxidation enzymes are upregulated. Genes are upregulated in an epigenetic fashion. So the beta-hydroxybutyrate is an endogenous molecule that the body makes, and it also functions as something called a histone deacetylase inhibitor that can impact the expression of genes that can have a positive effect on our physiology and our mental state, our inflammation state even.
Wow, that's powerful.
So and then so because it's affecting so many systems, it has a diverse amount of applications, and these applications really are very new, because 10 years ago when I got into studying the ketogenic diet, the only application really that was written about or published conclusively was pediatric epilepsy. And now there are so many different applications, and that's been really fascinating to see. You know, now it's pretty much low carb diets and ketogenic diets are accepted as a strategy for weight loss. They're accepted, you know, more so now for type 2 diabetes. Of course, you know, the neurological applications, including Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, Dravet syndrome, Rett syndrome, glucose transporter type 1 deficiency, it's actually the standard of care. In those situations, it can be the standard of care if the doctors choose to use it. We know it's effective. But now we're studying it for Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. There's a number of clinical trials that are ongoing, number of publications. Autism, my colleague who's the chair of neurology in Calgary, is pretty active in using this approach to manage the symptoms of autism. You know, brain injury, concussions, there's a pretty active area of research there, and brain tumors and different forms of cancer that we know are responsive to carbohydrate restriction and cancers that present what we call the Warburg effect, which means that if you image and use a PET CT scan, and you have a high level of indicator of a signal from a PET CT scan, that's an indication that the cancer, the tumor, is consuming, relatively speaking, much higher levels of glucose relative to the healthy tissues surrounding it. So one way to reduce the consumption of glucose by the tumor, which is impacting its growth and proliferation, is to reduce the availability of the glucose through your diet. And also, maybe even more importantly, is to lower the hormone insulin, because insulin stimulates glycolysis, which actually causes the tumor to feed on glucose at such a high rate. And the ketogenic diet does that remarkably well. When I followed the ketogenic diet years ago and got blood work, my insulin levels were like below the normal range. You know, I had a normal healthy insulin response to a meal, but my baseline insulin levels were very low, and that was pushing my body to metabolize proportionally much more fat than it's typically, and also starting to make ketones.
Right.
So it really does fundamentally change your physiology, and it is a rather extreme physiological state, you know, in comparison to what we're used to as a society, from the foods we are typically, you know, told to eat.
As a modern society, traditional, ancient societies and traditional diets, as you go back and look, would you say many of those traditional societies and are ancestrally speaking, looked a little more like a ketogenic, and especially if there was some fasting involved because food just wasn't readily available. Because I basically tell patients all the time, just eat like your great-great-grandparents used to eat. Of course, no one really knows what that is anymore. But that it falls in line, right, with what you're talking about.
Yeah. And even food availability, you know, many people think it's most healthy to graze throughout the day and have three meals and maybe like, you know, one or two snacks throughout the day and to kind of eat throughout the day. But I really think that, you know, time-restricted eating was a healthy part of what we did. I mean, fasting goes back in many cultures, you know, it's talked about in the Bible. And Mark talked extensively about fasting for seizures. There's fasting was something that was used through millennia. Hippocrates, 400 BC, talked about fasting for seizures. So I think we're largely silencing many of the health benefits that are associated with limiting food periodically. We're told that that's not a good thing to do nowadays. Right. And we know just from ancient literature, from PubMed, I mean, the literature on intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating is remarkable. I mean, if a drug did that, it would be a blockbuster drug.
Yeah.
If a drug could as rapidly achieve, normal blood glucose and insulin by just altering the feeding window, it's remarkable to see the effect. I mean, we're working day in and day out in the lab here, and it's in rodents, you actually see even a more robust effect in the ketogenic diet and time-restricted feeding. So, that can be magnified in different patients if it's implemented properly. But there's no doubt that nutrition should be really the cornerstone of medicine. And I'm at a university at College of Medicine, and that is just not taught. It's not on the USMLE. It's the students do not need to know it for the boards. But I will tell you that the students have a very large appetite, no pun intended, for knowledge and nutrition, because they realize that it's going to be really important to manage their patients, that 80% of what they see could have been prevented in the doctor's office just through proper nutrition. And exercise is important too, but I think even nutrition is something that there's just so much confusion in nutrition. And exercise, just really getting the body moving, lift a little weights, do some cardio, and then you can make some changes there.
Okay, we are back with Dr. Dominic D'Agostino, and we kind of got cut off there at the break. Had a little technical difficulty, but I want to summarize real quick the first half of the hour. In a nutshell, what we're saying, what Dr. D'Agostino is saying is, if you can limit the amount of sugar in your bloodstream, therefore in the food going into your bloodstream, and carbs turn into sugar, so you limit your carbs, that will limit the amount of sugar, or glucose is the other name for that, that's floating around in your bloodstream for fuel. When your body does not have that fuel to use, then it will go to this other source of fuel, which is your fat. It'll break down the fat for fuel, and some of those byproducts of the breakdown of that fat are called ketones. Those ketones can be used by the brain in particular as fuel. But these byproducts called ketones also have lots of other effects in the body. They turn down inflammation, and they turn on different, he even explained genetically. So certain genes can be turned on and turned off by these different breakdown products from the fats. And conversely, when you burn sugar for fuel all the time, that can actually drive inflammation. The insulin spikes drive inflammation and can turn on some of the bad genes also. So you're really killing two birds with one stone. You're dropping inflammation because the insulin's dropping because you're not eating the carb. But you're also turning on a lot of good physiology pathways in the body, biochemical pathways in the body, because of the byproducts of the fat breakdown. So, I mean, it's just a beautiful synergy here when you use medicine as food, as we've talked about. So I want to get into, and I don't know if you had a point to make before the break. Were you making another point, or are you ready for the next question?
Well, I think, that was stated very well. And I think one of the things that I didn't quite nail down, like you had mentioned, are the spikes. When you eat a normal high carbohydrate diet, you do have spikes in glucose and spikes in insulin. Your glucose levels may not change that much. Your baseline levels sometimes they go down, and sometimes they stay relatively the same on a ketogenic diet. But what you eliminate, virtually abolish or attenuate, is the insulin spikes. And it's those spikes in glucose and insulin that are really the triggers. They trigger pro-inflammatory cascades, and they could. That's really the thing that's causing the most harm is those postprandial excursions, I guess you would say, in glucose and insulin that are most detrimental associated with a normal diet. And they are virtually eliminated with a ketogenic diet meal plan.
Okay. So even if you do some occasional carb, higher carb meals, some you'll call this carb cycling, but say you're eating a high fat ratio, high fat, moderate protein, very low carb throughout the week, or maybe 10 days in a row, but then one day you throw in there more of a moderate to higher carb day. Now, not processed, you know, horrible carb. But if the ratio flips, will you be protected from a spike even in that particular day?
Well, I would still stay away from dense forms of starch and stay away from sugar. And I would still keep the carbohydrates low to moderate because, you know, if you stay away from carbohydrates, your body can become more sensitive to carbohydrates. You could. So I think that's important to acknowledge. So if you're getting 50 grams of carbohydrates or less per day, you don't want to take a day off and eat 500 grams of carbs. And it's fairly easy to eat that. I mean, if you just down some Cokes and, you know, have, you know, pasta and things like that, like dense forms of carbs. If you're going to have carbs, I would limit it to under 200 grams per day on a high carb day and keep those carbs low glycemic index carbs. So basically non-starches and try to have, you know, vegetables. If you do occasionally, I will go to the movies and have popcorn or something like that and be totally fine. But try to really, you know, kind of cap it. Just right. Don't go crazy. Because a lot of people and because if you do let yourself eat as many carbs as you want to be satiated, that can be sort of a dangerous cycle situation for some people.
Right.
And from a physiological perspective, but also from an eating behavioral perspective, I've seen it.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. A number of our patients have this kind of emotional, psychological interplay with the food, and that can make it a real challenge. And so you kind of have your cheat day, but then that reinforces some of the psychological aspects of the unhealthy food habits. That's a great point. I do want to touch on the cancer. You mentioned a lot of research going on right now with you personally and just around the country and the world with nutrition and cancer. You mentioned the PET scan and the cancer cells will take up glucose or sugar more readily, more aggressively. They'll bring that glucose in to grow so the cancer cells can proliferate aggressively. Have you seen in all your research a cancer cell use a byproduct of fat metabolism or ketones? Can a cancer cell use a ketone body or any metabolite of fat metabolism? Does a cancer cell have to use glucose to proliferate?
That's a good question, and that's what we're exploring now. We're trying to test some models that have that some other researchers have indicated are using high fat or using things other than glucose. So it is, you know, it's been known for many years now that the rates of glucose consumption are many times higher in cancer cells. And that glucose consumption rate is proportional to the aggressiveness of the tumor. So if you have a tumor that does not use glucose, that tumor is likely sort of indolent or very slow growing. So maybe something that you don't need to be as concerned of. I know early stages of, for example, prostate cancer doesn't really show up on a PET scan because the tumor is growing very slow. So that would be maybe one example. There are perhaps some different types of breast cancer or hormone-driven cancers. What typically you see is that as the tumor grows and becomes aggressive, that the mitochondria are defective, and they're structurally and functionally defective, and defective mitochondria do not use ketones well for energy, but they may be using the ketone through biosynthetic processes. So for example, acetoacetate may be used as a biomolecule for in vivo lipogenesis. So So the carbons essentially from amino acids like glutamine and maybe ketones are incorporated into the expanding biomass of the tumor. And tumors make a lot of lipids because they have to make a lot of cell membranes. If you make more cells, so the cells have membranes. So that could, they may not be feeding the energy of the tumor, but they may be feeding the biosynthetic processes, the building. But the growth and proliferation of tumors is a very energy-dependent process. And that energy is really coming from two sources. It's coming from glucose, and it's coming from the amino acid glutamine. In pretty much all tumors. More recently, there have been some discussion about different types of cancers, especially liquid cancers like leukemia. So I think CML, maybe certain types of leukemia and lymphoma may be using fats in the blood. And these are essentially liquid or blood cancers, maybe using the fat in the blood to allow for the growth and proliferation of these cells, of these cancer cells. Paradoxically, if you're on a ketogenic diet, the amount of fat in your blood goes down because you make your muscles and your peripheral tissues more hungry for fatty acids. So you are your peripheral tissues are consuming more fat, clearing the fat from the blood, and making the less triglycerides, less fatty acids available for these different types of blood cancers that may be growing off different kinds of fat.
Interesting.
So I have gotten that question because there's a few, I think one paper came out in Nature and a few others showing that different types of blood cancers may have the ability to use fats more readily as a source of fuel. So, and that brings up the question, well, should you be feeding a high-fat ketogenic diet? In many cases, the ketogenic diet will lower your triglycerides. That's actually one of the most well-documented effects of eating low-carb. It doesn't even have to be ketogenic. Eating a low-carb diet is that it reduces your triglycerides. And lower triglycerides in your blood means less fats available for these different types of blood cancers. So it's an area of cancer research that needs to be studied more. And I think specific types of therapeutic diets will definitely need to be developed for different types of cancers. Yeah. And our focus is primarily on brain cancer, you know, and I got into that because I knew the ketogenic diet could help manage seizures in patients with brain cancers in 2007. And then in 2008 or 9, you know, a number of publications came out showing that it's targeting cancer metabolism by targeting the Warburg effect. Mm-hmm. The Warburg effect, meaning you have elevated rates of glycolysis because there's impaired mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation. So oxidative phosphorylation typically involves generating energy from fats and from ketone bodies too. And if you have accelerated glycolysis, that glycolysis occurring independent of outside of the mitochondria, and the majority and cancer cells that are very aggressive use a much higher proportion of their energy is derived from glycolysis instead of mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation. So that fact, and this is a well-known fact that pretty much most cancer biologists would agree with. Some think that tumors have normal mitochondria because in various in vitro preparations, you could show that they consume oxygen. But just because cancer cells are consuming oxygen does not mean they're coupling oxidative phosphorylation with ATP production. Right. And if the mitochondria are structurally and functionally abnormal, it is very likely or most definitely certain that they are not making that their oxygen consumption is not coupled with ATP production.
Right. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say, well, in a nutshell, that basically means that, you know, changing your diet and I guess just the Warburg effect in general, which was just described, has major implications for cancer treatment, which needs to be recognized, and now it kind of finally is, and also has major implications for something that's not really talked about much, but also cancer prevention. So if you can establish a physiological state of your body, you know, and periodically go into a state of therapeutic ketosis, we believe from the animal models, and I think human studies is a very hard experiment to run, but we believe that that would be translatable to far less cancers for humans later in life. And the data is very compelling in that direction if you simply look at glucose regulation. So people who have hyperglycemia are much more likely to get a wide range of cancers, from GI cancers to gallbladder to liver cancers to endometrial cancers. So if they simply regulate their blood glucose and insulin, they would be much less likely to get cancer. And really, prevention of cancer is key. And there's little attention being put on that, but I think more attention needs to be put on preventing cancer altogether.
Yeah. Well, in medical school, we get trained very well in cancer screening tests, you know, do the PSAs and the colonoscopies and the pap smears and the mammograms and all that. Let's try to catch these things early, which really we're not catching them early. It's already, these cancer cells and tumors have been there a long time. But the prevention part, hardly anything at all. I mean, maybe there's more now. I've been out of med school for 15 years, but I don't think the curriculum's changed that much. So what would you say to an oncologist who is telling a patient, just diet doesn't matter, just get out there and eat a milkshake if that sounds good to you, and they're, you know, they've got M&Ms in their glass bowls at the waiting desk at the oncologist office, and you know, this thought that diet doesn't matter and sugar doesn't matter, and what would you say to a patient who's telling you that hey, my oncologist told me just go out and eat whatever I want to?
Yeah, well, I think the idea there, the oncologists really have a fear of patients losing weight. They have a fear about cancer cachexia,
right?
You know, muscle-based things. So we have a whole program just really focused on that, and we feel that that can be mitigated with therapeutic ketosis. So this is early research that we're doing now. Various model systems show that. But I think, I mean, all oncologists should agree with this statement, that if you lower the hormone insulin and you lower blood glucose, and most importantly spikes in blood glucose, and you lower the inflammatory state of the body, for example by high sensitive C-reactive protein, you know, we could use that biomarker, that if you do those three things, you are putting the patient into a state where he will be in a much better position to effectively receive the therapies that they're giving them, right? And they're also putting, most importantly, they're putting the patient into a state that's going to limit the growth and spread of cancer. So they would have to agree with that statement. And I think mainstream oncology centers now will probably agree with the statement that achieving a state of therapeutic ketosis, or lowering, you know, improving those biomarkers that I mentioned, will make the patient, make the cancer more sensitive to the therapy that's being given, whether it be radiation, chemo, or even immune-based therapies. And that will make the cancer treatment centers, you know, therapies more effective. So that's how we approach it. We are not necessarily, our lab is trying to pitch something that's going to replace the standard of care. I think at this point in time, we need to think about making existing therapies work better. And there are situations where a particular chemo drug or radiation has little or no effect in an animal model. But if you put that animal into a state of therapeutic ketosis and give the same treatment, it can eradicate the cancers. So Adrienne Scheck has shown this nicely in her work at Barrow Neurological Institute on a very aggressive brain tumor model, a GBM model, showing that in a state of therapeutic ketosis, the radiation worked, but only, you know, once you achieve that therapeutic state. So I think really oncologists and doctors need to really focus not so much on sick care, but really focus on health care and really delivering and really implementing nutrition as being an integrative or integral part of their integrative therapy. And they will have much better outcomes even with the therapies that they're giving now, therapies that are generating revenue for the centers. And I think that's an important concept for them to convey. I mean, I understand. I mean, we're basic science researchers, and we kind of have maybe an idealistic view of things or how it should be. But when you go to oncology clinics and you see it kind of does fall down on the bottom line. You know, they have to generate an income to pay, you know, the staff, the neuro-oncologists, and things like that. So the therapies that are evolving are improving. Not for brain cancers. But it's still a little bit disheartening to see that nutrition is gaining traction, that it should. To really our work here is to get nutrition on the radar, low carb nutrition, ketogenic nutrition on the radar of these oncologists.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your work in that and trying to get it on the radar. I mean, the rates of cancer being, I think, 1 out of 2 men, 1 out of 2.5 women in our lifetime are going to have cancer. So we need to open the minds to these other therapies that can be beneficial to the patient. I do want to move on to a couple other things. We've got about 10 minutes or so left. A question I often will get is, you know, people hear the word ketosis, ketogenic. They think of, at least with our diabetic patients, they think of diabetic ketoacidosis, a medical condition, life-threatening medical condition. Can you speak to that briefly, the difference between nutritional ketosis? I'm sure you get this question all the time. And this very potentially harmful, deadly condition called diabetic ketoacidosis.
Yeah, sure. Diabetic ketoacidosis is something that's very specific to someone with type 2 diabetes, or type 1 diabetes, I'm sorry, that has a deficiency in insulin. So when your body cannot produce adequate levels of insulin, and you are eating a normal diet, right? Let's start from that context. Your body can't use the glucose that's in the blood. It can't transport it in the cells. So the body goes into a crisis situation and starts making, because of insulin insufficiency, it stimulates fatty acid breakdown in the liver, and you have an out-of-control ketone production. So ketone production is regulated by insulin. And if you have an insulin that's not available, you have out of control ketone production that can be dangerous. It gets dangerously high into the 20 to 25 millimolar range. That a step order of level that's above, you know, what you make under normal physiological conditions, for example, with fasting or the ketogenic diet. I guess what's most dangerous about diabetic ketoacidosis is that the blood glucose is also high, right? If you're doing therapeutic fasting, like fasting ketosis and the ketogenic diet, your blood glucose is low, your insulin is low, but regulated and tightly coupled with your energy consumption. And the ketone levels are just low to moderately elevated and finely tuned and regulated by normal physiology. But without insulin, the situation could get very dangerous with a very high elevation of ketones, but even more dangerous, that's in a sort of a background of high glucose levels.
Right. So the key is insulin. In type 1 diabetics, there is no insulin. In the rest of us, we have insulin. So really a kind of a completely different situation. The names kind of sound familiar, but really totally different. And that state in a type 1 who has no insulin and is aggressively making these ketones, they get very, very acidic. And that's the real danger, is the body has to be in this very narrow window of pH, you know, around a 7.2, 7.3-ish kind of window. And if you start to get way more acidic, then you'll die. So the body has a way to, in normal folks, with the non-type 1s, the body regulates this pH balance very well and very tightly and beautifully mostly actually through the breathing and through the kidneys. You'll either breathe out or urinate out different things to maintain your pH. And I think I heard you give one lecture, maybe answer this question with some interviewer, to say that, you know, if you run up a flight of stairs, a non-type 1 diabetic, just a normal person without the type 1 diabetes, you'll put more pressure on your body to fix a pH. You'll induce more of a problem for the body to have to regulate pH just by running upstairs because you're breathing harder. And that's going to put more pressure on that system than a ketogenic diet would.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yep. So, you know, a diabetic ketoacidosis is a distinctly different situation fundamentally. Interestingly, my student is type 1 diabetic, and he wears an insulin pump, and he has lowered his insulin usage probably by about 60-80% by eating a low-carb diet that's often ketogenic. Right. And he finds that whenever you could use less insulin and whenever, you know, you can have tighter less variability in your blood glucose, that's a good thing. And any endocrinologist or diabetologist would be very difficult to argue that that's not a good thing.
Right.
And the way that he's achieving that, and many other people achieving that, actually there's a group called Type 1 Grit on Facebook, and that group of people was actually used more recently for a publication that came out of Harvard. David Ludwig was part of that study, in conducting that study, showing that you have tremendous control of blood glucose in type 1 diabetics with low-carb nutrition, using low-carb nutrition. And my student's name is Andrew Kutnick, and he did a TEDx talk that describes using low-carb for type 1. And interesting, you know, that was always the thing I would say 10 years ago when I said, well, if you are type 1, don't even think about this diet because it could be very dangerous. And actually, it's people like him and people, you know, that are really spearheading and know their disease well that actually had me change my mind about it. I thought it would be a little too risky in someone who wasn't making insulin, and then that would be just a risky thing to do. But it's actually implemented very effectively and even published now, showing the efficacy of carbohydrate restriction for type 1 diabetics.
Well, I can tell you from our clinical experience, we have a handful of type 1s, and that's what we see, is their insulin requirements reduce greatly. One patient, probably 90% reduction in insulin requirement, and a very, very level blood sugar levels, as opposed to the spikes up and down that most type 1s are used to. So That's really encouraging. I encourage those type 1s that are listening to get on that Facebook group. One other question before we've got to wrap it up, and I get this often, and I know you could probably talk a whole hour on this because this is so much of your research, but these exogenous ketones are basically these ketone bodies in supplement form that you can just take a supplement of it, not have to eat the ketogenic diet. The specific question I had from someone was, what happens to the glucose if you're going to be eating a higher carb diet and therefore glucose is in the blood, and then you're taking these ketone body supplements? What's going on? It doesn't the body preferentially still use the glucose because it's there? Does it store the glucose and use the ketones? But explain a little bit about when would you want to use exogenous ketones or supplemental ketones in a pill, basically, or a drink? And what's happening to your nutritional glucose if you're going to do that?
Sure, it's a good question. And, you know, I do think of ketones as a fourth macronutrient. There is a calorie-containing source of energy. So you could sort of ask the same question, right? What's happening to glucose when you eat protein? What's happening to glucose when you eat fat?
So
it's kind of like the same question. Interestingly, when you consume exogenous ketones, for reasons we don't fully understand yet, glucose levels go down. And the glucose, even if you consume 50 grams of glucose by itself and then 50 grams of glucose with an exogenous ketone, like a ketone ester, the elevation of blood glucose will be less with that 50 grams of glucose. So this is well-known phenomenon, and it's not fully understood what's going on. There are several reasons, and I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's a combination of things. There's the group at NIH and Oxford think that it's enhancing insulin sensitivity with their particular ketone ester, a monoester of beta hydroxybutyrate. And I do think that's part of the case. Another reason could be the exogenous ketones could be causing a small increase in insulin, and insulin is basically facilitating glucose disposal in tissues. So that occurs with a very large dose of a ketone ester, but smaller doses don't cause smaller doses of a ketone salt, for example, supplement, are not causing an increase in insulin because we are measuring these things, but it is lowering blood glucose. So the third reason we think that glucose levels are going down in response to exogenous ketone supplementation is that it's lowering hepatic gluconeogenesis. Pretty much all the glucose in your blood right now is coming from the liver, and the liver has very tight control over our glucose levels. And that's why, you know, medication that lowers blood glucose like metformin is really working on the liver, gluconeogenesis. So for reasons we don't understand, it's changing signaling in the liver to turn down hepatic gluconeogenesis. Probably, you know, it's sensing, hey, we have ketones. We have a source of energy in the blood. We don't need as much glucose. So it becomes, I think, from an evolutionary standpoint, it's very important if you're fasting to conserve the gluconeogenic amino acids in your skeletal muscle. So if your ketones are elevated, your body is basically trying to conserve what glucose you have available or glucose precursors, including the protein in your muscles, right? Because you could break down the protein. And it's probably why humans can fast for weeks at a time and not waste away, because the ketones are preventing the release of glucose from amino acids. So kind of a long-winded answer to your question, but I think the glucose levels, you know, your brain will still continue to use glucose. Even if you're fasting for 40 days, your glucose levels will go down, but it'll still be within normal range. I mean, it might go down, well, it'll probably be a little bit below the normal range, but there are very powerful homeostatic mechanisms that maintain our blood glucose levels. If we're breaking down fat, the glycerol backbone from the fat can become glucose. And then we're always sort of at a lower level breaking down various amino acids like alanine and glutamine to make glucose. So the idea is that we want to slow that amino acid breakdown to conserve our muscle, right? And the way we do that is by elevating ketones, which prevents that muscle breakdown. And also, breaking down fat, the more fat we break down, we use the fatty acids for fuel, but that glycerol can also keep a low baseline level of glucose going. And because glucose is needed by some cells exclusively, like red blood cells, there's even different areas of the brain. Some neuroscientists have reached out to me and, you know, showed me some data to indicate that certain areas of the brain really need glucose available, you know, into that 1 to 2 millimolar range. If you drop it below that, you know, bad things can happen. So glucose is always going to be available, but your body does a good job at making its own.
Right. So if someone's not going to moderate their diet that much, more of a standard American, and they hear about this ketogenic stuff and they just take a supplement, and I think most people are looking to lose weight, basically. Physiologically, if you're eating more of a high carb and taking this exogenous ketone, and the body says, look, I've got ketones for energy source here, so I can just store that glucose. So I would imagine you're not going to see the corresponding weight loss.
Well, you know, you got to figure if you're consuming ketones, it is a source of calories, but it really does. I'm of the opinion that calories matter. You know, I think, you know, some people argue the most important thing is, you know, the macronutrient ratios and your hormones. And I think that's important. But I'm of the opinion that, you know, you can't lose weight unless you have some kind of calorie deficit, right? If you don't have a calorie deficit, you're not going to lose weight. So what I think exogenous ketones allow a person to do is that they control appetite. They have a very powerful appetite suppressing effect, right, where it makes calorie restriction, you inadvertently do that without even having to try, right? So I think that's the benefit. It's essentially keeping your brain happy, right? Yeah, so right, the ketones go to your brain and say, the energetic status of my body is okay, you know, is good. Like the ketones can make neurotransmitters. They can, they basically, you know, if there's energy sensors in the brain, it's saying, okay, we have enough energy. Even when you might be at a mild calorie deficit. So I think, and on top of that, it tends to increase insulin sensitivity, which may be contributing to that, and alters some other things that may make fat burning more likely. But I don't think you should consume ketone, exogenous ketones, with the goal of losing fat. I think you really need to focus on nutrition. I think maybe if you have a neurologic, maybe if you have, you know, early signs of dementia, if you're at risk for seizures, you know, there's various, you know, applications for that. But the science is very early, and I would caution anyone to use these things, use exogenous ketones for medical applications that they have not been proven for yet. The research is still ongoing.
Right. Well, I think we're going to have to do a part two sometime, because I think we could go a lot more with this exogenous ketone topic, but also get into, you know, you've sort of touched on, but a lot of the neurological stuff, ALS and MS and some other things. So just a fascinating world of nutrition, fascinating world of this the ketogenic diet and all these beautiful anti-inflammatory effects and anti-cancer effects. And so anyways, I think we go on and on, but we're out of time, and I really, really appreciate you spending your hour with us. I think it's going to impact and help a whole lot of West Texans and Eastern New Mexico folks and other folks around the country that tune in via the internet. So thank you, Professor and Dr. Dominic DeAgostino. He's at the University of South Florida. Is there a way people can follow your work, a website or Facebook, or what's the best way to keep up with you?
Sure. My website is ketonutrition, all one word, .org. And, you know, I have a blog. I'll be posting a blog today, another one on there. So there are resources that actually show what exogenous ketones, you know, I recommend and prefer. And there's doctors on there. There's nutrition consultants on there. And some of my videos and podcasts are also on there too. So ketonutrition.org.
Awesome. Well, great. Y'all go check that out. And we'll love to have you back sometime, Dr. DeAgostino. Thanks for joining us today.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. This is Ben Edwards with You're the Cure. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.